Our last speaker is Tricia Patterson. She will be presenting The Day the Music Didn't Die, Preserving Music at MIT Libraries. Tricia Patterson is a National Digital Stewardship Resident at MIT Libraries. She began her career at the Texas State Library and Archives Commission before moving to Boston for school. In 2014, she graduated from Simmons College with an MS-LIS and a concentration on archival management. While at Simmons, she focused on digital preservation, digitizing textual collections at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Archive, and working as an editorial assistant for the Preservation Digital Technology and Culture, and a program facilitator for the Simmons Digital Stewardship Certificate. She has worked at several other Boston area institutions, such as Harvard, and the Boston Athenaeum, honing her interests in digital stewardship and archival outreach in educational settings. Thank you, Tricia.
Thank you. So I'll talk fast so you guys don't have to miss too much of lunch. So like she said, I'm Tricia Patterson. I'm the National Digital Stewardship Resident at MIT Libraries, so I've been contributing to some of their digital preservation initiatives. And I'm going to be talking about our digital audio music project, which is an initiative meant to digitize and preserve some of our music heritage at MIT. So our project has involved figuring out what we had that was at risk in our collection, because it wasn't really the physical analog stuff that we had wasn't really organized very well in our special collections, beginning with one batch of audio for Herb Pomeroy, who I'll talk about, and using that batch of audio to walk through, map out, and document all of our digitization and digital preservation workflows on a really detailed level. So part of our project was also assessing an optimal streaming platform for digital audio at MIT. So I wanted to begin by giving some background about the project and what it is, and then I want to talk about what has been done to gain intellectual control over the physical holdings before digitizing them and managing the digital audio content, which is where the handout that she's kindly passing out will come into play. And finally, I'm going to talk about our comparative review of access platforms or streaming audio platforms. So this is really like a start to end, what we've learned and what resources we end up with that could be applicable to other institutions. This is a picture of Herb Pomeroy. He's a jazz trumpeter and music educator. He was a jazz trumpeter and music educator around the Massachusetts area. He played with people like Lionel Hampton and Charlie Parker, and he had his own big band. So he was pretty influential up in our area and beyond. And he's who we focused our first batches of content on. The Lewis Music Library at MIT Libraries and Special Collections is a beloved corner of MIT Libraries by staff and faculty, students, and alumni. Music is actually the second most popular minor at MIT. All those brilliant engineers are also like maestros on the side. So for about 20 years, Peter Munstead, the head of the music library, has been keeping a to-do list. And one big item that was always at the bottom of the list, not getting done, was dealing with the library's collection of reel-to-reel tapes and audio cassette tape recordings. Those are mostly comprised of MIT music performances between the 1950s and the 1990s, a lot of which are performance groups, faculty recitals, outside artists performing at MIT, so a large part of the MIT history. So for a long time, the Special Collections recordings in the Lewis Music Library were uncatalogued. the other picture. Inaccessible, slowly deteriorating, but the staffing and money hadn't really been around as a priority. The music library is housed under the archives, which has great intellectual control of their holdings. And about 2 years ago, it was decided that digital audio would be a strategic priority for the libraries. The music library itself did some fundraising, and we had some generous donors happy to help with funding to finally deal with some of these recordings. So since the Institute Archives had the papers from Herb Pomeroy, who we were going to start with, it became a collaboration between them and the music library, combining human and financial resources and using the same systems to inventory and organize the assets. The Digital Audio Music Project, or DAMP, as it's kind of unfortunately known, became a joint effort between about 12 members, archives and music library staff, as well as curation and preservation services and IT. So in order to start preserving the audio portion of the collections, we had to really figure out what was even in there. Kate Gallivan, the project assistant in the music library, wrangled all of the physical controls. She inventoried everything, so now we have an idea of like exactly what formats need to be taken care of, and we can prioritize them. You can see there's a smaller digital portion that we'll also have to get through, even though I'm focusing on analog stuff, and the digital stuff is like CDs and DAT tapes. And then we have a bunch of reel-to-reels, cassettes, LPs, and things like that. She turned the mess of, this is what it looked like before, she turned the mess of unknown material that was in the music library special collections and barcoded everything and entered it into a, we're using like a FileMaker Pro database right now. And then here's just like a boring screenshot of the database. So we recorded metadata about the genre of music, formats, rights information, which has been a real problem for us, whether it was batched for reformatting, et cetera, so we can sort of track as we're dealing with stuff. So once all of the physical control was wrangled, all that was done, and we knew where we stood with the analog audio, we were ready to talk about reformatting and digitizing. And while there had been piecemeal reformatting projects in the past, there was never enough of a foundation set for archival and special collections material that it was like an efficient or secure process for that material specifically, like the unique holdings. So, by using the first batch of Herb Pomeroy material to document the process in low-level detail so we could really map it all out. And it was an involved process. You would think that workflows are just like, sure, I know what we do, we'll just write it down. It was pretty involved. So our goals of using this batch of Herb Pomeroy audio was to lay the foundation for the future of all of the content, to begin with audio and map it all out and then generalize it up. So to document the digitization process and then the managing of the digital audio or digital content in general, and then figuring out the best way to stream it for access. PAD is another unfortunate acronym. So Nancy McGovern, head of curation and preservation services at MIT Libraries and the president-elect of SAA now, first developed this high-level workflow, and I don't know how visible it is, but it's big-ish. So you can see the top sequence is all about managing the physical and analog material, acquisitions, processing, making the content available. The middle sequence, the A sequence, is the analog to digital or digitization workflow on the high level, which involves deciding which materials need digitization, defining requirements, reformatting, and returning the physical to the P stage. And the final sequence is managing the digital from acquiring born digital materials to ingesting digitized and born digital to preserving it and then making it all available. And the little rectangles down in the D thing are also our digital storage pathways that are connected to those stages. So each bubble up there is a stage of the workflow. So I came in as a working to document the low-level details of each of these bubbles or stages, and we focus, the stuff that was in scope was these last two, so the digitization and managing digital, which is what I'm going to show you now. Try to go through them quickly. So you guys have a handout of this one, the decide to digitize stage. In the handout, you can see there's a diagrammatic piece as well as a corresponding textual part. I only put the diagrams on the presentation because they're the only pretty part of it. And the textual part actually elaborates on the visual portion. It talks about what tools are used in the stage, when necessary, inputs from previous stages, outputs to subsequent ones. You can see at the top here is an isolated middle part. This is just the A sequences will go along. It's like highlighting the one that's doing it. So we started with A1, decide to digitize, mapping out the detailed process used using this batch of Pomeroy. Everyone came together to discuss their specific roles and decisions that needed to be made. You can see that yeah, the each high level bubble has the rectangles on it, and that is actually talking about like who's involved in the stage. So CC is content curator, and they're the only ones involved in the stage, which is deciding what needs to be digitized. The decisions that need to be made are called out in specific steps, project documentation that needs to happen. In our wiki, we now have templates for each documentation piece so people can jump in and know exactly what information needs to be recorded, and it's pretty, like, it's a much faster process now. And that's like the digitization project plan, little piece at the bottom there before you go out to A2. You can see in A2, which is determined digitization requirements, it's like the technical requirements, you can see there are a lot more roles involved. There's preservation services, the rights group, content curators, digital preservation, and reformatting are all involved in this stage. There's another documentation piece that's recording digitization project specifications. Again, we have a template for that now, so people can just come in and know exactly what needs to be filled out. Prepare content to digitize. So this is a more physical, like physical steps of signing out the materials, creating a new batch record, putting in them in the transfer container, and then pushing them out into, there are the, one of the handshakes. The handshakes are a really significant part specifically for archival and special collections. Prior in the reformatting process, there hadn't been a lot of successful negotiations between like archives and special collections needed to know exactly where their unique holdings were at all times. They couldn't just send like, oh, okay, reformatting's gonna take care of it. Okay, well, just let us know when they're back. They needed to maintain security and integrity for all of their unique holdings. So like the handshakes were like really illuminated a need for a tracking database, which we now have. And that's been one of the benefits of the workflows is illuminating needs for like for new tools and systems. This is the actual reformatting stage, as opposed to like planning and handling all of it. So you can see there's reformatting, content curators, and vendors or partners for P. And this is actually a slightly lower level one. And then there's a part one, a handshake to the partner, and a part two, which I'll show you. So part one is preparing the items for reformatting. Then they go out to the vendor or partner. For our audio, we've been using George Bled Audiovisual, which I think they're here, and you guys are probably very aware of them. The actual reformatting takes place. It gets, there's a handshake back to reformatting, and then there are two little things that they go to. The digital files go down into the D stage, which I'll jump into in a second, and then the physical files go back through the A stage and back to the P stage. So prepare and return the physical, handshake back to the content curator, and the content curator then decides whether or not they're going to keep or toss the material based on the previously documented decision. So now we're in the D sequence, and that's the isolated one up top. It's kind of bigger. This is the deciding to acquire the digital step. Again, we have a digital acquisition plan that gets documented. In D2, determine curation requirements. You have your decisions that are made, documented, and we like to call all the notifications or anytime communication really needs to be made in the little like green envelopes. Another handshake, and this is where all of the digital content comes in. So whether if it's from an external submitter or through the D stage or from the A stage, which if it's been digitized or formatted, it comes in and it's about to dump into our submission storage area. So we have, if you have like a physical medium, like a hard drive that's being submitted or just digital files, they'll go into the digital pipeline. Here where our storage pathways came into play, which they correspond with each of the stages, and it was a really good way for us to be able to like map out exactly what we needed, because as you'll see later on, we have temporary and archival storage, because this is for every piece of content now. It's not just for our archival holdings. Even general collections, digital content is being used, and that would go into temporary storage. So it gets a little technical with the proto-submission information packages that go out into ingest storage. The submission information packages turn into temporary information packages if we do not have a long-term preservation obligation to them, or a proto-archival information package if we do, and they're gonna go into archival storage. This is a side digital forensics step that either D3 or D4 can loop into. Finally, we have the managing the preservation object storage, and that's where both archival and temporary content come in. You can see archival storage would mean more like maintenance of the objects, so more often like more frequent fixity checks, migrations, and things like that, where temporary storage has a lot less of the obligation. Finally, you generate your dissemination information package. And that's it. And I'm actually going to talk about the next piece, which is us talking about how to disseminate this information. But before I jump onto that, I just want to say, like, all of these are actually, and I'll give a resource at the end, because the workflows have been really valuable for us. They're in a version one right now, and they'll keep fluctuating. It's an iterative process as things change at MIT, but they've been a really great foundation for like larger batches to pass through like a tested secure workflow a lot faster. There's been better transparency in tracking materials. There have been clearly defined roles and next steps for everybody. There's been accountability and transparency throughout all of the departments that, you know, are a part of this, and everyone's been a part of it. It's exposed existing redundancies and inefficiencies. It's revealed areas that could benefit from tools and automation. Speaking of tools and automation, it's also clearly defined roles for new tools. Like before, it was kind of like, well, what's a good archival processing tool? What's popular right now? Let's just fit it in and bend to it. And this has allowed us to really like map out our intentions and then find the best tool that fits with what we're doing. And also, evidence of planning is always good leverage for a request for additional funding. Something jauntier would be better for after all those workflows. I know they can get boring. So similar to our approach to the workflow, the approach to identifying an optimal streaming audio platform has been to document all of our needs first and then find the tool that best fits those needs, as opposed to just like grabbing something random and trying to adapt to it. This meant we began the review by assembling a group that represented the different stakeholders in the platform. So a couple of technology people, content curator people, a collaboration between the technological and organizational branches. So the first phase, it's a three-phase plan. The first phase has been assembling a long list, this is like a third to half of it, a long list of potential requirements for streaming audio platform at MIT. So this, we prioritize the requirements. So you can see here some of it is about display end user stuff, front end stuff. And then we prioritize the requirements. Four is at the bare minimum, it has to perform this. Three, for if it really needs to be able to do this or we probably can't actually use it. Two, if it's required but we're flexible for how the requirement is met. One, for if it's desired but not required really. And zero, for like, whatever, that's cool if it does that. And then we collected a list of contenders. A lot of you are probably familiar with a lot of these. So this is the list we compiled by reaching out to other music library colleagues, audio listservs, consulting with peers at MIT. And then we moved into the second phase, which was taking about 20 of our highest priority requirements and some organizational requirements, like would the system fit with our strategic priorities? What are explicit costs involved, resource costs estimated for open source? And we gathered the available information and tried to eliminate about four options from the list before moving to our full phase three review with all of the requirements. So for Avalon, the current incarnation, version 3.3, didn't really meet or provide enough documentation for about seven of our 20 high priority requirements. We think it may end up being used as an option somewhere within the libraries down the line. MIT's own Tech TV did not meet or have documentation for about eight of our 20 high priority requirements. It also didn't have the required flexibility or capacity for metadata inclusion, so we also aren't sure at the time what its future looks like, and that was a problem. And then Kaltura and ProQuest were each options that would have necessitated bringing out a sales rep to give us more information, and that wasn't really within the scope of our review. We wanted open source, open documentation options to pursue. So we're currently documenting our reasons for like our phase two results, and then we'll move into fully researching all of the functional and non-functional requirements for access to memory AD space, which is was born out of MIT, and collective access before bringing our recommendations to the department heads. So that's it, I finished up. That's my email there, and also if anyone wants to write that down, that's where you can find all of the workflows if you're interested, and like they're pretty general and could be like easily used as a foundation for other places as well. So yeah, I'm done.
Thank you.